Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. If Roe v. Wade is overturned in coming days, 13 states are waiting in the wings with so-called trigger laws that would immediately outlaw first and second trimester abortions. Ohio lawmakers are at work on their own trigger law. That means residents of states where abortion is outlawed will seek abortions in other states at abortion clinics that are bracing for an increased demand. Ruth Kolker is a professor at Ohio State University Moritz College of Law. Her work focuses on disability and civil and reproductive rights. Ruth, welcome back.
Thank you, Ann. Nice to see you.
Does the type of abortion ban in one home state affect where or how its residents in that state can seek abortions elsewhere?
Well, that's a really complicated question. States have been imposing different kinds of rules to try to prevent women from having abortions on the assumption Roe is overturned. Some states are not only banning abortions from conception, but are also banning women from traveling to another state to secure an abortion. Under normal times, I would say that that's unconstitutional to bar women's ability to travel to another state. Usually states are not allowed to interfere with travel across state lines, but these are not ordinary times and this court's hard to predict. Another big issue, which I'm sure your other guests will also wanna talk about, is the existence of medication abortions. And so if a woman could have a telehealth appointment with a physician in another state or another country, she might be able to obtain a medication abortion. But again, the states are banning that mechanism. The FDA is trying to take some steps to protect medication abortion, and there may be an executive order on that subject. Again, hard to know what this court will say about that kind of rule that many states are trying to put into play.
Do you think that it's conceivable that the Supreme Court ruling will address all of these issues?
Absolutely not.
Right.
There's no chance. Now, I think one question is, will the Supreme Court decision use the phrase, we are overturning Roe versus Wade? Mm-hmm. These trigger laws have different language about what triggers them, right? And so, there's no way to know until we see the final text. And honestly, that draft opinion to me is not worth really looking at closely until we have a final text. But it will mean a lot whether or not that magical phrase is in the Supreme Court opinion.
Could we just back up a second and just do some logistics here with the court? When is the decision coming? I know you're not prescient, but when's the decision coming out? What's left in terms of the days it could be coming out?
The court normally ends its term by the end of June, June 30th. Sometimes there's some small spillover into the first week of July. So I would say July 7th is the absolute last date I can imagine, but more likely it'll be June 30th, July 1st. Usually the blockbuster opinions are decided last or handed down last because there's so many concurrences and dissents. You know, this is going to be a voluminous set of opinions when they are issued.
And your remark about you almost said it's not worth the paper it's printed on kind of a thing as far as that draft opinion. You've seen draft opinions before, you know they can change a lot?
No one has seen draft opinions before. It's unprecedented for them to be leaked. But since it is a draft, it is a draft. I think you've seen drafts, I've seen drafts. I think that we know from the historical record in other cases that when the justices vote after oral argument, that typically that vote holds, but not always. And there's some very, very famous cases where it was 5-4 in one direction after oral argument. When the final opinion was decided, it was 5-4 the other way. Now, I don't expect that that's going to happen in this case. I think there's no doubt the Mississippi statute, which is really what that case is about, mm-hmm. will be upheld as constitutional. But the details in the vote, what do five justices say, is something that's very hard to predict. Obviously, the draft opinion gives you, you know, better betting odds, right, than without it. I don't want to say it's irrelevant, but it is a draft.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and we're kind of looking at if Roe v. Wade is overturned one way or another in coming days. 13 states are waiting with so-called trigger laws that would immediately or very quickly outlaw first and second trimester abortions. Ohio lawmakers in the Republican-controlled Ohio General Assembly are working on a trigger law of their own. That means residents of states where abortion is outlawed one way or another, if Roe v. Wade is overturned, will want to seek abortions in other states, or at least think about that. And we're talking about the logistics and the legalities of that now. My guest is Ruth Kolker. She's a professor at Ohio State University, Moritz College of Law. Her work focuses on disability and civil and reproductive rights. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're interested in hearing from people who have had to travel across state lines in the past, who have had to go proverbial extra mile to attain a legal abortion. 614-292-8513. You said if it doesn't, you know, or you said if it actually says it overturns Roe v. Wade is one thing. What if it, what are the other iterations? I mean, I suppose there are many, many, but what are the most logical expectations of other iterations?
Well, the narrowest ruling that the court could render, given its conservative composition, is that the Mississippi statute is constitutional, which bans abortion after 15 weeks of pregnancy, but that this court will not speculate about what other measures might also be constitutional. That's the narrowest decision the court should render. I don't expect that to be the majority opinion. But that would obviously be a very, very incremental change in the status of abortion in the United States. It would certainly not permit states like Texas, Oklahoma, and other states to ban abortion at 6 weeks or at conception. That's the narrowest. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask you, what's the larger question in the Mississippi case that could potentially bring about the overturn of Roe v. Wade?
Well, when Mississippi first defended their state statute, they merely asked the lower courts to uphold their state statute and not to go further than that. But as the court's composition changed, as the case wound its way through the courts, they shifted their posture to be more aggressive and to argue that Roe versus Wade is unconstitutional, so that the very underpinnings of abortion protections is not within the Constitution. And so they did make that argument before the United States Supreme Court, and therefore the court is permitted to rule on that issue. And so there's many ways for the court to uphold the Mississippi statute. It doesn't have to overturn Roe versus Wade to do so, but that now is centrally part of this litigation.
You said in ordinary times, states can't control women's who travel across state borders to seek an abortion or anything else. What's ordinary times and what's different now?
This court is what's different. Six conservative justices is unprecedented in recent memory. I actually can't remember when the court was ever this conservative. You know, maybe I'm missing something, but this is an extremely, I mean, I guess the 19th century, but, and maybe that's a good comparison, but you know, the court that found the Dred Scott wasn't a citizen of the U.S. That was a pretty conservative court too, but that was a long time ago. So that's what's hard. This, you know, I used to tell my students in constitutional law that, you know, there's many different avenues for progressive reform if that's your agenda. You can seek legislation at the federal level. You can seek legislation at the state level. You can seek Supreme Court decisions. You know, you can seek decisions under your state constitution. You know, you have many different avenues. You can do local government advocacy, you know, before city councils. And what this court has amazingly been able to do is close all of those progressive steps, every one of them. And it's just amazing. This court that supposedly thinks that federalism is important, is very uncomfortable with city government doing things to protect progressive aims. And so that's why it's very hard for me to understand what's going on right now, because there's no clear conservative thread that ties all these decisions together. And it is possible that some members of the court will see that. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's
federalism when it suits them, and it's states' rights when it doesn't.
You got it. That's a very accurate description, right? And I hate to be so cynical, and it's in con law when I teach it. I mean, I say my job is to teach the students what the court's deciding. Mm-hmm. And some of my students will like it, some of my students won't. That's not my job to convince them what's right or what's wrong. But you can see a very clear path, which has made it very difficult for progressive members of society to attain reform through any of the avenues that used to be available.
For clinics in so-called abortion islands that will emerge if Roe v. Wade is overturned, for those clinics, abortion clinics bracing for an increased demand, are there legal issues to prepare for too?
Well, it is not impossible that this court will eventually say that the fetus is a person. If it goes that far, which is what the Polish Supreme Court has concluded,
yeah,
then it will be hard for any state to protect the right to secure an abortion. It's also possible that based on the midterm elections and future elections, the presidential elections, we could have 60 Republicans in the Senate and they could choose on a national level to ban abortion. And so neither of those are immediate problems, but they're not far-fetched given you know, the direction that we're seeing things go in. The other thing that is going to happen to the people practicing the what you call the abortion islands is that there will be pressure on them to do telemedicine to people in other states, to send prescriptions to people in other states. They have to be really careful about that because they don't want to lose their medical license. Right now, more than half of all abortions are medication abortions. So you can imagine the pressure on someone who's performing abortions legally in Massachusetts to put a prescription in the mail to someone in Louisiana. But we'll have to see what happens. It's so awful. I just think it makes more sense to mail the prescription to the woman in Louisiana and have her to travel from Louisiana to Massachusetts.
Are there other rights that parallel this that are examples of how states are would be restricted from offering something like an abortion, access to an abortion, I should say. I don't know what it would be, but maybe just people who drive across state lines to Michigan to buy pot.
I don't know. I mean, another issue for your listeners to be aware of is the effect on contraception. So right now, I think about 15% of women use IUDs as their favored contraceptive mechanism. And many of these state statutes would bar the use of the IUD. And that, you know, 15% of all women of childbearing age, that's a lot of people. And I have no idea what this is going to mean. Will a doctor have to yank the IUD out of a woman when he or she sees that they have it, you know, at their annual exam? So what I would call the cruelty in that sense, just to bar even the use of contraception, is something we have to worry about too.
Okay, contraception. I mean, but that would be another issue for another day, right? Wouldn't it?
Well, barely another day. Griswold, which is the case that protects contraception, is really decided with exactly the same analysis as Roe. If anything, most commentators would probably say it's more weakly decided. But also, the states that are banning IUDs aren't banning them as a form of contraception. They see the IUD as stopping fertilization in the same way that the morning after pill does, and with Plan B, which they also will want to ban. So I think they will categorize IUDs as not contraception. We've already seen that in the Supreme Court in some various cases by religious entities that object to having their healthcare plans cover IUDs. It's already happened.
I know that you don't want to, you know, hew too closely to the leaked draft, but I'm curious about your thoughts about Justice Alito's reference to tradition and how that plays a role in abortion rights in the United States.
Yeah, well, you know, when the 14th Amendment was ratified in the late 1800s following the Civil War, women didn't have the right to vote. You know, women didn't get the right to vote, you know, until the 19th Amendment was ratified. And so, you know, I see women's right to reproductive freedom as part of their equality interest as citizens of the United States. And if you see it as part of women's equality interest, you'd have to say that equality interest developed after the 14th Amendment was ratified. Some people are saying that we should make a 13th Amendment argument, that the idea that a woman would be forced to stay pregnant for 9 months involuntarily, you know, is a form of enforced slavery. I don't think this court's probably going to accept that argument. We might see at the state level arguments about equality under state constitutions. State constitutions aren't necessarily the same as the federal constitution. But if you're going to do an originalist argument about women's place in society in the 19th century, it's not going to help women very much in any area of the law, including the so many cases decided by this court on women's equality interests.
You mentioned Poland. They have completely outlawed abortion there, and women are dying because of that. What can you give us a little thumbnail of what the Polish exercise is teaching us?
Well, it's just horrific. I don't know if you saw, I think it was in New York Times.
Yeah, recently. Yeah.
Yeah, it was just horrific. I mean, just to give one personal example, I've had three miscarriages, unfortunately, and the common thing after miscarriage is to have further medical treatment to make sure that your uterus is healthy so that you can give birth later. That medical treatment is identical to abortions. And so I was living in Louisiana at the time of two of my miscarriages. And if I were living there today, following Roe versus Wade's reversal, I probably wouldn't have been able to have the medical treatment I needed to be able to give birth successfully later, you know, to two healthy children. So that's just one example among many. But it already we're finding that women in Texas, doctors have trouble getting access to the medication that women need following a miscarriage to keep their uterus healthy. And so if you believe in the importance of women being able to reproduce, it seems pretty awful to make it hard for them to maintain a healthy reproductive system. But that's one of the many consequences of those kind of, and then of course, there's the women who are gonna have illegal abortions and all that kind of stuff. I mean, there's not being able to go to an emergency room for care because they're afraid of the treatment that we receive there. And there's the parade of horribles is really terrible.
Well, Ruth Kolker, I appreciate your time today. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks for sharing your story. I appreciate it.
Sure, thank you.
That's Ruth Kolker. She's professor at Ohio State University Moritz College of Law. Her work focuses on disability and civil and reproductive rights. We're going to continue our conversation. We're looking at if Roe v. Wade is overturned in coming days. 13 states are waiting in the wings with so-called trigger laws that would immediately or very quickly outlaw first and second trimester abortions. Ohio lawmakers at work on their own version of a trigger law. We're going to talk about the logistics of all of that going forward. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. If Roe v. Wade is overturned in coming days, 13 states are waiting in the wings with so-called trigger laws that would immediately or very quickly outlaw first and second trimester abortions. Ohio lawmakers are at work in the Republican-controlled Ohio General Assembly on their own trigger law. Three abortion funds in Ohio, that is organizations dedicated to securing abortions for individuals who are seeking them, are working on strategies to continue their work in the potential wake of an overturn of Roe v. Wade. Women Have Options is one of these organizations. Maggie Scotese is the interim executive director of Women Have Options. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Anne.
And still with us is Ruth Kolker. She's a professor at the Ohio State University Moritz College of Law. Her work focuses on disability and civil and reproductive rights. Ruth, again, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So, Maggie, explain what an abortion fund is. To tell you the truth, I'd never really heard of one before recent months.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually hadn't heard of an abortion fund either until I was in law school. And one of my friends in law school, her roommate actually worked for the abortion fund. So we help people who want to access abortion care figure out all the logistics of accessing and paying for that abortion care. So we have two patient navigators. So when folks call into our hotline, they help them figure out what the cost of their abortion abortion is going to be, help them get an appointment, and then figure out all the logistical barriers of accessing that care. So whether that's transportation, lodging, childcare, the cost of food, all of that, we help them figure out and make sure that they don't have to delay care for lack of payment.
And so we could like post a link to your website on our website, and then that's what people would, they could just go to that and find the number to call, kind of a thing, right?
Absolutely. We have our website as well as a lot of social media. We have TikTok. We're everywhere.
Okay. Women Have Options is the only statewide fund in Ohio, right? Can you give us a little history about how Women Have Options came to be and why there's only one?
Yeah, absolutely. So our founder, actually, her friend needed an abortion. We were founded about 30 years ago, and her friend couldn't pay for her abortion care. And so she got a group of her friends together from their local church, and they raised the money to pay for the abortion, and then started the abortion fund after that to help other women in their community be able to access the care that their friend needed. And that's kind of where we're still at today.
It's interesting. Ruth Kolker, I'm interested in abortion funds and how they came about. And also, we've been talking, asked you about clinics, you know, abortion clinics, but abortion funds, could they be somehow caught up in the swirl of liability if other states start banning people from going to other states, kind of a thing?
That's a great question, Ann. I mean, obviously, it depends on what the state statute says. We'd have to read it closely. But I think if you think of the Texas statute right now, the bounty hunter statute, you know, they do go after people who facilitate the abortion. It could be apparently the Uber driver, you know, whoever facilitated the abortion. And so there might be a knowing requirement, but in this case, the purpose of the abortion fund is to facilitate an abortion. So I don't want to be rendering legal advice to a nonprofit. I'm sure they've thought about this, but you know, they would have to obviously be mindful of what the Ohio statute says and whether they are arguably violation of that statute. They never have criminal penalties against the pregnant woman herself. They always find other people to go after, and I guess that could be one of the ways they try to go after them.
Maggie Scotese, are you aware of whether or not the proposed Ohio trigger law legislation, there's two bills pending, I guess, would affect the work that you do?
Yeah, so it absolutely could. Anything that contains an aid and abet clause or anything about funding for the abortion or helping somebody to access that care would cover the work that we do. And Professor Kolker is absolutely right. We've been working with attorneys and preparing for this for a couple of years, actually. So we have plans in place to figure out, depending on what the law actually says, what we're going to be able to do legally and how we're going to make sure Ohioans can still access care.
What do you know about what the language is now, the pending, the proposed legislation?
So one of the problems with the proposed legislation is that it's really vague and it's really hard to know exactly how it's going to be impacted.
So are they dealing with this behind closed doors or are they having hearings? I mean, what are you hearing?
So they have had hearings. We've been at all of the hearings so far. I think there were three, but the legislature has now gone on recess. So we don't expect anything to be happening over the summer. And the Senate has indicated that they're not really interested in pursuing a trigger ban until we get a Roe decision. So we may get something back when they come back into session in the fall. But actually, we're expecting more than likely it's going to be during the lame duck session at the end of the year.
Okay. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the legal, the logistics, the physical, financial, and more logistics of women seeking abortions in the United States in the potential wake of an overturning of Roe v. Wade at the U.S. Supreme Court. If you have a question or comment, we like to hear from people who have had to travel, who have had logistical challenges when seeking an abortion. Hear from you. Tell us, what you did and how you managed and what the expectations at the U.S. Supreme Court suggest to you. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So you're statewide. You work with women who are Ohio residents?
So we work with anybody who is either currently living in Ohio or traveling to or from Ohio.
Okay. And I call you up and I say, I want to get an abortion, but I don't have a car.
Mm-hmm.
I have the money to pay for it, but I don't have transportation. Would that be hypothetical?
Yeah, absolutely. We see stuff like that all the time. And so in that case, we'll figure out how far they have to travel to their clinic and figure out if it makes sense to do an Uber ride or use one of our volunteer drivers. Or sometimes it may just be they need money for gas or somebody to watch their kids. And so we'll help them figure out how to cover those costs or figure out what the barriers are and get them to address it and get them to their appointment.
Can that mean that you would give them money? You have grants?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Okay. We give direct funding to patients all of the time. We do block grants to clinics to help cover the cost of care. And then through our patient navigation service, we also provide direct grants to folks, whether we are paying them directly or paying for the service in their name.
And when you say you've been working with lawyers about preparing for potential limitations on what you do, like what?
So figuring out where how we could comply with other laws that we've seen around the country. We're very well connected with other abortion funds across the country. We're a member of the National Network of Abortion Funds, so we have meetings with our friends in Texas and our friends in Alabama and Mississippi who've been living under abortion bans for much longer than we have. And they and their lawyers and our lawyers talk and figure out what are some ways that we could get around the clauses in the legislation. So are there ways that we can continue to help people, but that don't limit or that don't put us at risk or our clients at risk?
Ruth Kolker mentioned earlier that the courts have gone a long distance in limiting what progressive minded groups can do these days. Do you feel that pinch?
Oh, absolutely. It's getting increasingly hard for us to do the work that we're doing. And it's really frustrating because it feels like a lot of folks in the greater society don't realize how close we're getting to losing access or how hard it's going to get until they actually need to access care.
Do you see, envision, and Ruth, chime in, I'm wondering if there's, if one of the ways to get around this or the potential limitations would be a group like Women Have Options working through an organization in, say, Illinois, where abortion is expected to still be available.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just, you know, again, I haven't researched this, but Ohio law can't reach people in another state, right? And so let's say they reincorporated in Illinois. I'm just making that up. Okay. Actually, Illinois is not going to have abortions. So I don't know what's the closest state. Depending on what happens in the Pennsylvania governor's race, maybe Pennsylvania. So they reincorporated in Pennsylvania. It's a little hard for me to see how the Ohio legislature, Ohio law could reach funds coming from Pennsylvania to Ohio from a Pennsylvania entity. So I don't know if that's one of the options they're considering, yeah. But that might be the way you would have to do it, that each of these states that permits abortion would have to have its own fund instead of the fund being in Ohio.
Maggie Scotese?
Yeah, so we've got a lot of different options, and we're trying to not be too set in stone about what exactly we're going to do until we know what the law is. Like, that's one of the hardest parts about this is we don't know when the Roe decision is going to come down. We don't know what the law is going to be. And so we've been playing this game for several months now where we're just trying to figure out how to keep access now and how to make sure folks know how to contact us and how to get accurate information about what the law is and what their rights are in the moment.
What are your thoughts or expectations, I guess, from watching the hearings so far and listening and working on this, that you know, as we were talking about earlier, more than half of abortions are medication abortions in the United States now. That's probably as true in Ohio as it is anywhere, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a sense that the legislation in Ohio will address that specifically?
Probably not. A lot of the legislation we're seeing is either very confusing or very vague. And a lot of legislators just don't understand abortion, like from the medical side, as well as from the practical side. We see legislation that has abortion definitions that include things like IUDs or things like the morning after pill, or saying that reimplanting an ectopic pregnancy would be considered an abortion. And those are all medically inaccurate and not based in reality. But that doesn't matter if that's what's being written into the law. So it's very confusing.
You must be getting calls from people. You had an influx?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've had an influx of folks wanting to support us, whether that's financially or volunteering with us. But also our demand has gone up increasingly.
What do you make of that? Not more women than usual are getting pregnant and seeking abortions. So what does that mean?
So part of it is people are reaching out more for emergency contraception. Okay. We have a free EC program where we provide emergency contraception to community centers.
Just to have on hand.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So if people need them, they can go, like we partner with the Garden here in Columbus. They can drop by the Garden and pick up emergency EC. But also just folks are scared and folks are calling to reach out because especially in Ohio, if the trigger, when Roe is overturned, we will most likely very quickly be under our 6-week ban, which is currently stalled in the courts.
Okay.
But if Roe is not
that's
overturned.
That's the heartbeat bill.
Correct.
So-called heartbeat bill.
The so-called heartbeat bill. Yeah, correct. So when folks are 6 weeks pregnant, they're only 2 weeks past a missed menstrual cycle, assuming they have regular menstrual cycles. So most folks don't know that they are pregnant until about 7 to 8 weeks. And so that means most folks who are accessing abortion won't know. So we're seeing an influx of folks who are reaching out to us if they even have an inkling that they might be pregnant.
I know you aren't doctors, but I mean, is having access to pregnancy test part of this?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. And pregnancy tests are not only sometimes hard to access, but they are a lot of times in situations that are not safe. So one of the most common places for folks to get reliable pregnancy tests for low-income people are crisis pregnancy centers,
okay,
which are state-funded. I think they currently have like $7.1 million from the state of Ohio right now. They're not medical centers. They're not regulated. And they are created to pressure folks to not make decisions about their reproductive choices in a clear and free manner. And so folks will end up in these clinics and face stigma and face harassment at the hands of these clinic workers that are not medical clinics, and they only wanted to go in there for a pregnancy test or for supplies.
I'm wondering too, all right, so on that score, Ruth Kolker, confidentiality is a big issue. Is there going to be any protection for women who might go to a crisis pregnancy center just to find out if they're pregnant or not? But can they maintain their confidentiality? Can they keep it private?
Well, that's a real concern for a lot of people, because if someone has reason to believe that you are breaking the law, you know, I'm not an expert in this area of the law, but that is sometimes used as an excuse to violate patient privacy. And you may have read about this in the news, but you know, a lot of women track their menstrual cycles, in part to find out what time of the month they might get pregnant, and just track their menstrual cycles, period. And now they're afraid that data of their menstrual cycles might somehow get leaked to people who are going to say they had an abortion because of the menstrual cycle data. I mean, you know, it's you know, that the Texas case that you probably followed involving the woman who was arrested after and visit to the emergency room. In that case, a medical professional or social worker or someone, you know, called the police and she was arrested. You might say that was a violation for medical privacy as well. Again, in normal times, I would say the medical privacy is a sacrosanct right,
mm-hmm.
but these are not normal times.
And you're planning for that as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So we know CPCs aren't covered under HIPAA, so they already don't have the protection of general personal identifying information. But also, I think Professor Kolker alluded to this, that miscarriages are also criminalized because so many folks are turning to self-managed abortion. And self-managed abortion through medication, which is, it's perfectly safe and can be done at home. But it looks exactly like a miscarriage. You cannot tell the difference, medically speaking, if you follow the WHO guidelines, the World Health Organization guidelines.
Uh-huh.
There's not a blood test that can test for it. And so anybody who has a miscarriage is at risk of having their pregnancy outcome criminalized under suspicion of it being
or
a self-managed
being
abortion.
Accused or
right, and being
suspected.
Put in jail. The Texas case.
But I thought that was unlikely that they were going to criminalize women.
It's unlikely that they're going to criminalize white women, is the reality. Brown and black women have been criminalized for their pregnancy outcomes for years. If, When, How, which is one of the legal organizations in reproductive justice, has been doing a lot of work. They have the Repro Legal Helpline that helps people who have been criminalized for their pregnancy outcomes navigate that process.
Maggie Skotese, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
You bet. Maggie Skotese is the Interim Executive Director of Women Have Options. That is a statewide organization known as an abortion fund. It's an organization dedicated to securing abortions for individuals who are seeking them for any reason. Coming up, more on the topic, if Roe v. Wade is overturned, what happens next? This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We are waiting to see what happens if Roe v. Wade is overturned in coming days. 13 states are waiting in the wings with so-called trigger laws that would immediately or very soon after outlaw first and second trimester abortions. Ohio lawmakers in the Republican-controlled Ohio General Assembly are working on their own plans in that regard. In the meantime, some states are introducing more protections for legal abortions. Illinois and Colorado are on track to become strongholds for abortion access. The Hope Clinic, an abortion provider, is situated in Granite City, Illinois, near the border with Missouri, which is one of the 13 trigger law states. Hannah Dismer is a licensed clinical social worker and an education and research coordinator for the Hope Clinic. Hannah, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me, Ann.
Thank you. Ruth Kolker is also with us. She's a professor at The Ohio State University Moritz College of Law. Her work focuses on disability and civil and reproductive rights. Hannah, how is your clinic planning? I mean, we just heard from Maggie Scotese of Women Have Options, an abortion fund in Ohio, how they've been planning for a couple years to deal with this issue. How is your clinic planning to balance service between Illinois residents and everyone else coming from out of state?
So we've been dealing with this for years. Back in 2019, most of the abortions in the state of Missouri actually stopped happening because of just anti-abortion legislation that that Missouri had enacted.
More and more restrictions on abortions and access to abortions.
Yes, yeah. A 72-hour waiting period, a doctor has to be the same one to consent as to do the procedure, mandatory transvaginal ultrasounds, things of that nature. Mm-hmm. So we've dealt with this with Missouri already. In fact, only about 30% of the patients we see are actually Illinois residents. In the past year, we've seen patients from 21 different states, 2022 alone. And we have been staffing up. We opened a partnership with our local Planned Parenthood affiliate, Planned Parenthood of the St. Louis region in Southwest Missouri, called the Regional Logistics Center, where it's basically a hub coordinating funds, practical support agencies for travel, and it serves both patients at Planned Parenthood in our region as well as patients at Hope Clinic.
What's the sense that you have the support you're going to need going forward?
I feel like we have been operating in crisis mode since 2016, 2015, arguably earlier. And so since we're operating in crisis mode, like we're used to this and we have been preparing it. I think, you know, the majority of Americans are pro-choice and support abortion access and don't want Roe v. Wade overturned. And SCOTUS is set to go against the wishes of the vast majority of Americans. I think that we have a lot of support, but unfortunately, you know, where we are situated is in a very red part of Illinois, right across the river from St. Louis.
That's interesting. I mean, the location has more to do with the demand from Missouri, right?
Yes. Well, we've been here since 1974. And once we started doing abortion services, that's what we became known for. But yes, because we're 10 minutes from downtown St. Louis, 25 minutes from St. Louis International Airport, Missouri residents in the St. Louis region don't have to go far for an abortion, but they do have to cross state lines, which is a huge barrier.
21 states, some of those maybe among the ones that have trigger laws in place already.
Yes.
And that may ban women or from going to other states to get abortions.
That was legislation that was proposed. I was in Jeff City a couple months ago testifying against that legislation. But yes, banning people from traveling for abortion care has been proposed in Congress in Missouri. And, you know, we want everybody to know that if you can get to Illinois, you can have a safe legal abortion. And we are not subject to the laws in any state but Illinois.
If things change on that score, I mean, are you preparing for how your role changes if laws start going in that direction? And as Ruth Kolker mentioned earlier, the way things stand, they could. Whereas maybe 20 years ago, she would have said, no way.
So we're not so worried about Illinois. Fortunately, we have Chicago, which is a very big blue hub. We have support from Governor Pritzker, and we have a Reproductive Health Act enshrined in law in Illinois, all which protect us and the patients that we serve access to care. What I'm more concerned about is the fact that I am a Missouri resident who travels across state lines to provide care, and looking at the as are a lot of our providers at both Planned Parenthood and Hope Clinic.
You are then under the thumb of Missouri law as a resident, right?
As a resident, yes. I am licensed in Illinois, but I am, yes, I am a lifelong Missouri resident.
Ruth Kolker, what about that?
You know, this is funny, almost funny, but it's not, right? Because it's serious. You know, again, Missouri can't pass a law to affect conduct taking place in Illinois if the only thing, and the abortions aren't being performed in Missouri, so really the only thing they would be doing would be banning Hannah from getting in their car or whoever you get across state lines, you know, to engage in interstate travel. The right to interstate travel is actually in the Constitution.
Right.
Like it says it. And supposedly these originalists care about the text. And so I have trouble understanding how Missouri could constitutionally reach someone like Hannah merely driving across state lines. It's like we have a tariff at the border, and it's a really enshrined constitutional principle that we do not have tariffs at the border. That's why we became the United States of America, to not permit those kinds of tariffs. So again, I'm not offering Hannah legal advice, but I think it would be hard to reach someone like Hannah, but of course it doesn't mean that they won't try. And that itself is expensive for Hannah to have to worry about legal expenses and being arrested. Who right. wants that, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's an onion we're peeling today. There are so many levels to this, Hannah. Are you concerned? I mean, have you thought about moving to Illinois?
So like Ruth was saying, I don't think that actually upholding the like interstate travel bans would actually be upheld. But I'm not even sure the extent to what this Supreme Court is capable of. So part of me is like, no, they can't do that. And another part of me is like, I think they're willing to do almost anything, especially when it comes to restricting autonomy and reproductive rights. You know, if I can't provide care living in Missouri, I will move to Illinois. But that being said, I'm a lifelong Missouri resident. I help Missourians get abortions every day, and I'm not going to stop no matter what Missouri does.
Healthcare providers are across the board are already experiencing employee shortages. How is your clinic working on that issue, and how does that play into this? You know, given go ahead.
We have definitely been affected by employee shortages and just difficulty hiring in this economy. And so, you know, some things we've done is we have raised staff wages across the board. We have been actively recruiting, and we've actually hired quite a few staff members in the past 2 months to, you know, get prepared for whenever this decision does come down from SCOTUS.
What kind of pushback are you getting from the anti-abortion rights groups out there? Are you feeling any particular heat, or is it the same old, same old?
So, I mean, same old, same old. They're outside right now.
Yeah. I figured.
Yeah, harassing people, yelling at people. I always say I think it's super bizarre to yell at someone outside of the gynecologist. But I digress. We've been dealing with them. We have had some increase in security incidents and needing for, you know, just more security personnel and more security cameras and those types of things. One thing that we are cognizant of is that as abortion access gets more limited, the clinics that still provide care are going to be targeted more. And we already have people that travel all across the country to different clinics to, you know, tell that clinic what they think. But I think this is something that we've been preparing for a long time and have a really long history of anti-abortion violence actually against our clinic. In 1982, our former owner was kidnapped. And also our original building was firebombed in that same year. So we know what it's like to be on the, I've had death threats myself to my face. So we know what it's like to be on the, having to be on the defensive in that regard. They're not going to intimidate us away from providing care. And if anything, we just have to learn how to adapt and respond even more.
What are your expectations as far as needed resources going forward? Because it's hard to understand the cost of litigation at this point and what it could mean to you as an individual, as an organization. Are the resources there? Are they coming in?
We do have a lot of support from local agencies, from, attorneys and from the community at large. I think we're prepared for whatever's coming. The bottom line is, though, that if we're not going to stop providing care, we're not going to let these intimidation tactics be effective, because we really want to provide care and our patients deserve the best quality care possible.
Ruth Kolker, the abortion provider community has shrunk a lot in the last 30 years, a lot in Ohio, everywhere. Has that shrunk the resources that are out there to help them navigate what's ahead?
No, I mean, I'm on the national board of the ACLU, and we devote a huge number of resources to protecting our reproductive rights. And I think we've been on the lead, I think, of virtually every important case in this area. And I can assure you, we are following it really closely. Planned Parenthood also, it has a very active footprint. I think progressive people understand the importance of this issue, really understand it. And maybe other people don't, but progressive people with a pocketbook understand it. And the ACLU has had record donations, during the Trump era. And even during the Biden presidency, it hasn't fallen off that much because everyone understands what's at risk right now. Obviously, not just abortion, but so many other issues that are really important to us.
And in the world of unintended consequences, maybe, or maybe they knew that this was a possible consequence. The New York Times article is saying that abortions have gone up, possibly because of decreased access to contraceptives. Do you see that, playing a role in this, Hannah Dismer, going forward?
I think that as access to any, this is all part of the same boat. Banning abortion is just the tip of the iceberg. This isn't about abortion. This is about fundamentally about power and control and about enforcing white supremacist, classist patriarchy on U.S. residents, specifically people with uteruses, people of color, and people with disabilities. I am concerned. I'm definitely concerned about all these attacks, but I'm also concerned that people are going to need more abortion care, because we already see states trying to limit the use of emergency contraception or intrauterine devices. And I have no doubt that they'll come after IVF. They'll come after different fertility
treatments.
In vitro
fertilization. Okay.
And they're also coming after trans health, which is also a part of reproductive health and bodily autonomy. So I think that those things are all very interconnected. And it's not going to stop with abortion, because this isn't about babies. This is fundamentally about a white supremacist society trying to exert power and control over its citizens.
Hannah Dismer, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Hannah Dismer is a licensed clinical social worker and education and research coordinator for Hope Clinic. That's in Granite City, Illinois, near the border of Missouri, which is one of the 13 trigger law states that already has extensive limitations on access to abortion. Ruth Kolker, professor at Ohio State University Moritz College of Law, thanks again for all your time. I really appreciate it, Ruth.
My pleasure, Ann. See you soon.
Thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.